Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, before your Q3 call, I've got the campaign brief ready, built from last quarter's data and the competitive landscape.
Great. Did you include the differentiation angle the CMO asked for?
Already in there. Three angles no competitor's using right now. Just need your approval.
Approved. Thanks. Oh, agents, where would we be without you?
Somewhere with a lot more tabs open.
Create your first Monday agent in minutes at monday.com.
Final hour here on Darren Donick and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Willie Donick, Marquise Munson, along with Elijah Campbell running the show today with Darren and Chase on vacation today and tomorrow, taking a little long weekend. We'll be back with them on Monday. We are excited, as always, to be talking with Elliot Friedman from Sportsnet, Hockey Night in Canada, always at the forefront of what's going on with the NHL. And Elliot, we're still looking day by day, getting closer and closer, hopefully, to some action to call here. I know Roman Josi talked with the media yesterday and talked about where he is in the process here. And you guys hit on some things that I honestly had not even thought about. But let's start with this, because I think this is an important thing. A lot of people were asking Roman yesterday, you know, when will the whole group be back in Nashville? How many of the guys are here? Have you seen some of them? When will you actually hit the ice? And you pointed out something that has been discussed behind the scenes, and that is, you know, what the NHL has recommended for people that have gone home, when they should try to plan on being back so that everybody's ready to go July 10th.
Yes, one of the things that happened is that some players have visas, and those visas in the NHL, the NHL calendar goes from July 1st to July 30th, and as a result, a lot of players, their work visa ends when their contract is up. So it's June 30th. So, you know, we know the playoffs, if they happen, they're going to go past. They're going to go into August this year and September and potentially October. And so I think what's happening is that they're telling guys, hey, you know, because of the pandemic, it's hard to process these visas. You've got to be in the city. I know you're not supposed to be back until July 10th right now, but we need you back earlier. And the word they use, because it can't be mandatory, is strongly encouraged by June 21st. Now, I know a bunch of players aren't crazy about this, especially the ones that have to travel from overseas. They don't want to have to come back 19 days before they have to get these visas done. But, you know, that's one of the realities of the world now. And I'm curious to see how I think one of the things we're finding out now, guys, is that they want to be sure they're starting on July 10th. Like, if they have to come back on the 21st or close enough to it, they want to come back on the 10th. They want to know that they're going to be practicing for sure on the 10th. And I think that's one thing they're really trying to hammer out right now.
Another thing that I guess what you're saying, Elliot, is you feel like the players will eventually, if they're going to err on the side of caution, but do you foresee some hiccups to where maybe not everybody will be ready to go on July 10th, where a team might have one or two guys that are still waiting to get all of the paperwork done?
Pardon, I cut out there for a sec. Say that one again.
Do you feel like on July 10th there might be a few teams that have a couple of guys here and there that have not gotten all the paperwork done, that are still waiting to get the full clearance?
I don't think so. I think, though, that I don't think that's going to happen. I think that's why they're telling guys get back sooner. And I think most guys probably will end up doing it. As long as they know they're getting close to a protocol deal and a CBA deal, I think you're going to see most guys kind of accept this.
Something else that I'm looking at the Sportsnet website, Sportsnet website, players won't be expected to wear full face shields if NHL returns. It just gets a good discussion going. The proximity that you're on the bench, the coach yelling all the time, you know, all of the things that we've been conditioned to know are things that potentially could spread the virus here. So how are they addressing that? Because they want the players to be able to play without being too restricted. You got to be able to play, but they want to be as protective as possible.
Well, I think that what's going to happen here is that you'll see, like, if you looked at the NBA rules and regulations over the past couple of days, I think you realize that what they're going to do is they're going to attack it with a restrictive bubble. You know, people are going to be allowed in. They're going to fight hard to keep them in. They're going to keep the amount of people around them really light. And, you know, there was a report yesterday that they're going to rely on full testing as opposed to full shields. I think a lot of the stuff the NBA did is going to be the kind of stuff the NHL is going to decide to do. And I think what they're going to argue is they're going to argue for the best way to keep everybody safe is a restricted bubble. And if you look right now, I think the way this is going with some of the spikes we're seeing is that they're looking at saying, look, you know, today what happened? The University of Texas had 13 positive cases on their football team. The University of Houston had 6 last week. We've seen the numbers in Arizona, and there's all sorts of rumors about, you know, people in Arizona and positive tests and stuff like that. You know, I have no confirmation or anything like that yet. But, you know, I think what they're saying is if we get them into an atmosphere where it's just them and nobody else can get in or out, or we try to keep it as airtight as possible, we can create a situation that's as safe as anything else out there. And I think that that's the way that they look at it. It's the testing, not necessarily, and the fact that they're going to be isolated as opposed to what's going to happen or not happen on the ice.
When do you think we'll get the official announcement of the hub cities? There's been a lot of reporting of Las Vegas is going to be one of them. I guess the other one we're waiting to see, maybe a lot of thought that one of the Canadian cities be one. Where are we on that, and what's the timetable?
I think that it's coming soon. I think they're just waiting for official clarification on the Canadian cities, as in, can these Canadian cities can these Canadian cities include the rink in their quarantine? And we've been expecting that official announcement for about 4 or 5 days, and it's still not done yet, but people think it's coming. So I think they're waiting for that. And that's when I think we'll get the hub cities announcement. I think they'd like to have one in Canada. There are some places in Canada that are pretty clear when it comes to COVID cases. You know, I agree. I'd be shocked if Vegas wasn't one of the two. And I'd also be surprised if Vegas didn't host the Stanley Cup final and the Final Four. But I do think they'd like to come to a Canadian city for one of the first for the first two rounds and the play-in round. I just think we're waiting for final clarification on the quarantine rules. And I've heard they're going to be happening tomorrow for about the last 5 days. So I think we're expecting it. It's just not done yet.
We're talking to Elliot Friedman. And Elliot, speaking of the hub cities, and when you look at the NBA's plan and their bubble in Orlando, which two, you know, cities in the NHL do you see making the most sense to try to duplicate what the NBA has in Orlando?
Well, I do think Vegas is number one because you can put guys in a resort, and you know, you've got your restaurants there, you've got your casino there, you've got enough of an ability there to do things that, you know, it's pretty easy to keep them entertained. I don't know if there's anywhere else kind of like Disney or Vegas that you can do the same kinds of things, but you can still create hospitality suites and you can create things like that to entertain players. I do believe Toronto is a place where they've done a lot of events in the past. They've got a lot of good hotels there. They can do a lot of interesting things where they can put players very easily. I've heard that the one concern about Toronto is that can you put enough of a bubble on a place that's got such a big, downtown population? That could be one of the concerns. But, you know, I don't know if there's anywhere like Disney or Vegas anywhere else. Those are two pretty unique places, and that's why we all like visiting them so much.
Yeah, that's right. Especially Vegas. Especially Vegas. You lose a lot of money Vegas. In Vegas, but yeah.
You know, L.A. could probably do that with their L.A. Live downtown. They could do some stuff. But again, it's not like Disney or Vegas.
No, absolutely. And Elliot, do you expect any NHL players to ever be vocal about, you know, not wanting to play due to the health concerns that obviously all this provides?
I don't know if they'd be vocal, but I think I'd be shocked if there weren't some. Like, there are players in the NHL who have type 1 diabetes. You know, there are players in the NHL that have asthma. I don't know if vocal, but I think we'd be shocked if everyone played. I understand, guys, that they are working on language about that right now, about players who don't feel comfortable for whatever reason and what the process for that is going to be. I think there's also concern about coaches and executives. Some of them are older. Obviously, we know that the older you are, the more vulnerable you are. And, you know, I think that one thing that has happened, I know because I've talked about it with a couple players, is, you know, players are creatures of habit. This is not the time they're used to playing, and they're not crazy about it. I think if everything works out, I think they're going to play. But, you know, I think they're not just crazy about summer hockey. And, you know, but again, I think what they want to know is it's going to start July 10th. I think one of the reasons that got announced is because they wanted a date. They wanted a target date. They wanted to know what they're working out for. And I think they want it to start on time. They want to know that that's their schedule. And I think that's why the league announced it. And I don't think any of us know if we're going to be able to finish this. I think we all hope so. But every day something new and something different happens, right?
Yeah, right. And Elliot, we talk about the other leagues that are starting up, you know, with the NBA, and we look at the commissioners of these leagues. You know, Adam Silver, you know, has the trust of his players. But with the complete opposite, you look at Rob Manfred, who does not have the trust of his players, and they're still going on this ongoing battle. And NHL was obviously able to come up with, you know, what their return to play plan was going to be. So, can tell us about, like, those players and having that trust and that instilling in Gary Bettman.
I don't know if there's trust. I mean, there's been a lot of labor history here, right?
You're right.
So I think there's a certain wariness on both sides. And people are losing money, and both owners and players. And as you guys know, whenever that gets involved, that causes a problem. The one thing I think that they've done a really good job here is they haven't let it spill out in the public. Like, you guys have seen what's happening with baseball. It's so tone deaf. You people don't want to hear this garbage right now. They just don't. Everybody's suffering. They don't want to hear about, you know, baseball players and owners fighting over money. They just give me my games. That's what they think. They think this is stupid. So I think what you've got is you've got the NHL players being well aware of this and the league being well aware of this, and they're trying to work it out so that, you know, they can get a deal done that makes sense, and any of the public or any of the private anger doesn't bubble over. So I think there's a wariness, but I think there's a recognition that you can't let that happen publicly.
I'm talking with Elliot Friedman from Sportsnet. And Elliot, we've had a lot of discussions here in this market, especially today in the show, about Roman Josi versus John Carlson for the Norris Trophy. We've kind of given a bunch of metrics, a bunch of numbers, but if you were to make Roman Josi's case, what do you think he's got on his side over John Carlson that might give him that edge to win that award?
Well, you know, I would tell you right now that they were the two final guys on my ballot too. Alex Pietrangelo was third, but, you know, the first two were Carlson and Josi, and I think that there's a big separation between the two of them and everybody else. You know, when I looked at Yossi's case, the stuff I looked at, guys, was that when you guys were really struggling, like, you go back to that game on New Year's Day, he played 33 minutes. And then I looked over the next, I think it was 20 games, when, you know, when you guys were still really struggling and you made the coaching change.
And didn't have Ryan Ellis, by the way.
I think he played less than 25 minutes twice over the next 20 games. And I think the lowest he played was like 24-11 or something like that. And he basically held you guys above water. Now, his ice time went down after that. Ellis came back. His ice time went down. And the team started getting better. But I looked at that stretch where if you guys had fallen apart, your season was over. And I thought he almost single-handedly kept you guys above ground. And to me, that was a big part of where I thought that Yossi's case could be made. I thought he really, I considered putting Yossi on my Hart Trophy ballot. I didn't, but I considered it. And I thought at that point in time, he really saved your season. And that, to me, is where I would make the best case for him.
So, obviously, Elliot, you're not sharing. No pressure. I mean, feel free. I don't know. Do you guys, from where you are, I know, I think Adam Vingan, we talked to him at The Athletic. Eventually, they go public with their votes. I know there's a lot of discussion.
I assure you, I don't feel any pressure. You know, the NHL asked us not to reveal all of our ballots because there was one year we did it, and they're like, you guys are ruining the awards. So the NHL asks us, don't reveal all your ballots. So I pick one every year that I reveal early, and this year I did the Calder, which is Rookie of the Year, and I voted for Quinn Hughes. I generally will pick one that has more of a Canadian bent to it since I work for Hockey Night in Canada. Right. But after the awards are announced, all of the votes become public. So you'll be able to tweet your hate at us if you don't like our votes.
Well, we certainly appreciate the thought you put into it because that's really where it all comes down to. I vote on the Jack Adams, right? And me and Chris Mason and Pete Weber and Hal Gill, we try to have some good discussions before we, you know, throw our ballot in there. That's important stuff. So thanks a lot, as always, for your insight, Elliot. We'll wait and see. We'll keep our fingers crossed, of course, here. We're all rooting for Roman, but we will see how it all turns out. And we'll hope that they can maneuver towards the actual next action on the ice here very soon.
Absolutely, guys. Have a great day. Have a great weekend.
All right, Elliot, thanks a lot. That's Elliot Friedman. Good stuff. And that was good. I was curious to see if he would share what it was, but that is a good policy to have because you don't want to, you know, have people sort of looking around and piecing together votes and revealing who wins before they actually have the reveal. And I don't know when they're going to do that, but maybe next week that's what we'll talk about. Will they actually reveal the awards before the action resumes? Because they have plenty of time to fill to get people excited. That could be something that they can do.
I never want to know who votes for these awards. Like, I just...
I know.
Like,
or you don't want to know at all?
Yeah.
Not even after the fact?
No, I don't even want to know.
Oh, I want to know. I want to at somebody. That's me.
You don't want to know the one guy that didn't vote for Derek Jeter for the Baseball Hall of Fame?
I do. Okay, that one, yeah, that's different. I want that one. But, like, for Heisman, like, if a guy votes for... I think at one point somebody voted for, like, a running back. One of the running backs from Wisconsin voted him, like, second or first place one year. And I was like, everybody was trying to find who it was. And I'm like, of course it's somebody from Wisconsin. Like, who cares? Like, I don't want to know. Like, I just keep it secret. Keep it secret.
There was also a baseball award. I can't remember which one it was. I'm foggy today, but there was some award where a guy that lost out very close in a close vote. It might have been an MVP. It might have been a Cy Young, but there was one voter that didn't have this person on the ballot at all. Like, not even in the top 20. And that might have been the difference between winning and not winning. And everybody was trying to find this guy and say, you know, you didn't even have him in the top 20?
But like, see,
how could that be?
The reason why I don't want to find it is because I know other people go very, like, overboard when finding out about some of these things. Like, if I find out, I just want to ask, like, why? Like, why did you not put Jeter in your Hall of Fame?
Accountability. No. Yeah. I want to know who to trust, personally. Like, yeah, Mike Wilbon voting against Jacob deGrom to win the Cy Young one year because of his win-loss record. Like, I need to know if I need to listen to your baseball opinion or hockey opinion, you know, going forward, or your Heisman opinion, what you take into account too, just for that accountability thing.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Will.
Well, that was a good piece by Elliot right there, talking about that section of the season that Ryan Ellis was out and Roman Yossi's increased ice time. And it was a continuation. Actually, it was before Ellis got hurt. They were struggling before Ellis got hurt on January 1st. I referenced the few games before that where Roman Yossi had this incredible stretch. I think he had goals in five straight games and just put the team on his back. He continued to do that. And that section of the season is very important. Keeping the team afloat as they changed coaches and waited for Ryan Ellis to get back. And then there was a bit of an uptick, quite a bit of an uptick. After Ryan Ellis did return, Yossi's play during that was essential for sure. So that it just shows you that he had done his research. He'd done his homework on that. That's important. Not everybody does that level of research for these.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I look at MVP like the same way of basically how valuable are you to this team? Like if this team were to be without you, if we were to just take you out and then don't put anybody else in there, what would that team look like? And that's kind of how I look at MVP a lot of times, is that's how valuable that player is if you take him off this team does not look the exact same. Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs, I don't think the Chiefs could play looking the same without Patrick Mahomes. And that's kind of how I judge some of these awards too. Same thing for Rookie of the Year with Ja Morant. If the Grizzlies didn't have Ja Morant, we'd pretty much be talking about the Grizzlies sitting at home with the Knicks right now instead of being in a playoff hunt. So I take those things into consideration.
When we come back, there is a counter proposal by the Major League Players Association, as we thought there might be. And so we'll give you the latest on that. And we'll also talk about Dr. Fauci's comments about the NFL and some of the issues that they're going to have to deal with that we haven't heard a lot of detail yet from the NFL. They've got more time. Time's on their side. But eventually they're going to have to make some decisions along the lines of what these other leagues are doing. Baseball, we know what their situation is, but we've focused a lot about the NHL and the NBA's return to play, the bubble, so to speak. What's the bubble going to look like for the NFL when it comes time? We'll talk about that when we come back. Stay tuned. This is ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're back here on Darren Donick and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Great conversation with Elliot Friedman. We have certainly covered the hockey front today. We started the show with a discussion with Tyler Kepner from the New York Times about where baseball stood after the breakthrough meeting between, the seemingly breakthrough type meeting between Tony Clark and Rob Manfred, face to face, one on one, no lawyers or negotiators clouding and complicating things. They thought they had an agreement from Rob Manfred's perspective. Tony Clark basically made it known last night and this morning, not so fast. We got to get the approval of everybody. And Major League Baseball has come back today with a 70-game proposal. So now we have a 60-game proposal where the Rob Manfred thought we had an agreement. Players come back with 70. Can we please just say 65 and be done with it? I don't think it's that simple. But there is still some optimism that they're progressing here, that this is a step forward, as frustrated as we all are.
I'm looking at Jeff Passan's tweet right now about the 70 games, and I'm just praying and hoping that this, like, someone doesn't come out and say, well, it's official, Rob Manfred and the MLB does not approve of this proposal, and we get right back to square one. So, Willie, you got to understand, like, because around the same time we got the news about the last proposal, and that got shut down. So I'm not too excited about this. I do look at the split in playoff revenues, which I think that's where the MLB will be like, nope, there's no split in playoff revenue. Take what we gave you, or we're just right back to square one. That's what I'm worried about, is the split of playoff revenues is what's going to say MLB's going to be like, nah, we're not doing that.
Just call me when it's over, please. I can live with 60. I can live with 70. I can live with 65. Just get it done. Get it done.
But see, there's always there's always like just one thing in the proposal that gets disagreed
right. by. But this is the thing, though. This is where Tony Clark is going to have to take the bull by the horns a little bit here. All right. And it looks like at least Rob Manfred, he had a proposal that the owners had said, yeah, you make this deal, Rob. If you can make an agreement, that's what Rob Manfred thought he had. I don't mind the players coming back with one more proposal, but you can't just keep doing this. Tony Clark has to be the leader. And he has to say, I'm making the decision. This is the best deal we can get this year, and it's going to be 62 games or whatever it is. But make the agreement, and don't go back through all the 30 teams and all the players and all the player reps. Of course, some of those guys are not going to be satisfied. Some of the agents that have a skin in the game here, they're all going to say you can get more. But that's the whole art of a compromise, right? You got to make a decision, and you got to have a little bit of give and take. The players can declare a victory by saying they stuck to their guns and they got the full prorated salary, right? That's going to be something right. That's in this equation here, whether it's 60 or 65 or 70. So, you know, enough is enough. All right. Let's not go for the extra cherry on top necessarily. Tony Clark, look at the best deal, make the decision, and let's go. Let's move forward.
And as frustrating as this process has been and kind of how annoying it's all, the whole thing, the whole saga has gone over like these last 6 weeks, but wouldn't you at least, both of you guys, at least say that the sense of urgency of coming back with a plan or a rebuttal plan maybe a day after, you know, they had talks for the first time face-to-face yesterday is at least a little more encouraging than
yes.
different proposals
yeah,
in the past?
Absolutely. They're trying
it's
to get
better.
Something done.
It's better.
Because, and yeah,
but
there's
we're all
some
exhausted.
Urgency. Yeah, it's
we're
exhausting.
We're just exhausted here. Please get it done. I don't want to even know the last few details. I don't even care. Just tell me by the end of the day or tomorrow morning, we're moving forward. Here's what we're doing.
I think they know. Now. I think they know that they're losing interest. And the more and more this goes on and this drags on and all these other sports are coming up with bubble plans and players playing ping pong in the bubble and NHL coming up with their plan and MLS is starting in a couple weeks and they see all this going on and they're knowing that they're losing interest of fans, not just the diehards, the fans that only, you know, check in and out like me who just, you know, sometimes watch baseball and sometimes I don't. And they know that they're losing interest in those people, so they need to be like, hey, we need to come up with something because if we do come back, it might not be to nothing because we might have our fans go completely off the rails and just say, you know what, I dealt with all this that you guys had going on and you guys were arguing about money and all these other just ridiculous things, so I'm done. And they know that, so they know that, you know, we got to get this stuff done now.
Leaders have to lead. Let's go, leaders. Get it done. All right? I've said this in so many different areas of discussion during this time, right? Leadership is so important in how we get through all of this. Now, let's turn our attention back to football. Dr. Anthony Fauci said, basically, I think he said this to CNN. Yes, CNN, and I'm reading it off of ESPN's website, though. Unless players are essentially in a bubble, this is talking about the NFL, insulated from the community, and they are tested nearly every day, it would be very hard to see how football is able to be played this fall. If there's a second wave, which is a possibility, and which would be complicated by the predictable flu season that happens every year, football may not happen this year. Now, people have taken parts of that, put it on a headline, and everybody's freaking out. If you just, for example, read a headline that said, Fauci, football may not happen this year, everybody's freaking out. What's going on with Dr. Fauci? He's crazy. What's happening? But when you read the whole context of that, it makes perfect sense. It falls right into line consistently with what we've been learning all along with this, right?
Right.
And so NFL people have not really revealed any detail at all about the bubble, so to speak, right? We're learning about the bubble in the NBA. The details are coming out. We're learning about the beginnings of the bubble in the NHL. We don't know all the details yet because we don't know the cities that this is going to happen in yet, although it's getting closer. It looks like Vegas will be one. It looks like a Canadian city might be the other if they can get all of the visas and immigration, all of that stuff worked out. It looks like they're waiting on that. Baseball at least has gone through some of this, but of course, baseball is a little bit more conducive being outside. The players are spread apart more. Maybe it's a little bit easier nut to crack. Football is tough. The colleges, we've heard a lot of discussion about it. What are they going to do in their unique circumstances on a college campus? What's the NFL going to do? That's my question. And when are we going to start to hear this? They've allowed They've been smart, right? They've got time to figure this out. But what's happening behind the scenes as they try to put all this together? Because what Dr. Fauci is saying is right. You know, football, there's a lot of collisions. There's a lot of pileups. The weather is going to be getting colder. So what's your plan?
Nah, absolutely. And I never, like, when I read off this, when we saw the schedules for the NFLs be released, I'm thinking, how are they going to make all these traveling plans happen? You know, how is the Titans going to be able to go to Denver? And how are they going to be able, you know, travel to Green Bay later in the season, especially if there's a second wave of this thing that happens? How is all this traveling stuff going to happen? And so when you mention the bubble, I just find it hard to believe that the NFL will be able to get a bubble done, because where are you going to have this bubble? You have a 53-man roster. You got coaches, position coaches. You got, obviously, your strength and conditioning and all these other people. So how would you do a bubble? When the NBA, it's easier because you got your 12 players and, you know, keep the three other players, you know, at home. You got your coaches. Some of them may travel. Some of them may not because of, you know, health issues or wherever. But you got less of a travel and less of containment when it comes to NBA players. But with the NBA, you got a lot that you got to deal with, a lot. And that's a 53-man roster that you got to take in a bubble. And so that's the point of figuring it out. And I think we've been focusing so much on the other sports and their return to play. We haven't really looked the corner of the NFL and just been like, hey, by the way, you guys are still here. What are you guys doing exactly? Are you guys going to travel? Like everything's fine? Like, this is the normal thing? College is going to have that same problem as well. I'm just like, how are we going to get this done?
The NFL is such a different animal, too, because it's different than the NBA and NHL, because they've also cut the amount of teams that are playing in their season. I mean, the NHL's cut their teams down. The NBA's cut theirs, so they're not having the entire leagues in these bubbles. And for colleges, at least you have the element of putting them in, like, a dormitory setting. Whereas in the NFL, I mean, are you going to separate the AFC and the NFC? Are you going to separate them up in divisions and have multiple different bubbles to accommodate these 53-man rosters and then coaching staffs training staffs?
I get the impression that they don't even want to have a bubble.
Yeah,
right? They just want to play the games in the stadium and figure out how many fans they can get in there. But
that's the only way. I mean, I really can't logistically think of a way you can do a bubble in which you're going to be able to socially distance, have proper sanitation for everyone involved, have enough space for everyone involved. It is almost impossible to me to have an NFL season inside a bubble. They're going to have to figure out something that's not a bubble idea.
Yeah, are you going to, like, separate? Are you going to have a bubble for each team, like each division? Are you going to have a bubble for each conference?
Like, you got to play games outside your division. You can't just play eight games.
Right. I mean, there's no way they can. That model just is not, it's not going to work. But how can you try to mitigate, is the word we're using a lot. We've certainly learned what the word mitigate means. It's been used a ton, but, you know, minimize risk is kind of the thing. So Adam Schefter has a statement from Dr. Alan Sills, who is the NFL's chief medical officer. Dr. Alan Sills, for a lot of you that may not know this, he's actually a Nashvillean. He actually lives here in this area and has for a long time. Here is his statement in the wake of this. Dr. Fauci has identified the important health and safety issues. We and the NFL Players Association, together with our joint medical advisors, are addressing to mitigate, there's that word again, the health risk to players, coaches, and other essential personnel. We're developing a comprehensive and rapid result testing program and rigorous protocols that call for a shared responsibility from everyone inside our football ecosystem. This is based on the collective guidance of public health officials, including the White House Task Force, the CDC, infectious disease experts, and other sports leagues. Make no mistake, this is not easy. We will make adjustments as necessary to meet the public health environment as we prepare to play the 2020 season as scheduled, with increased protocols and safety measures for all players, personnel, and attendees. We will be flexible and adaptable in this environment to adjust to the virus as needed. So, in other words, what he's saying is we're working on it. We know this is a tough challenge. Everything that Dr. Fauci is saying is going to be part of that challenge. It's tough. I mean, football is conducive to spreading this virus. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah,
so they've got a lot to work on here.
Yeah, when we mentioned it earlier in the show when we talked about moving into phase 3 of basically just saying, hey, we have to adjust. These are not normal things that we've having to go through. Like, we're not used to going into restaurants with mask, or the grocery store with mask on, or the, you know, having to check our temperatures before we go to work, or and working with only a few amount of coworkers in your building. Like, a lot of these things are new, and a lot of these things that we're going to have to adjust to. It's just a lot harder when you're the National Football League and you got 30 some teams in the league, 53 man rosters, and a lot of coaches that you also got to deal with.
All right, when we come back, we'll actually hear a little bit more from Dr. Alan Sills, who represents the NFL, the chief medical officer, and get a little more insight of where he's coming from as far as what is the plan for the NFL to tackle the coronavirus and play the season, minimizing the risk as much as you can. Stay tuned. We're coming back with that after this.
Well, we're still working on the final details of our protocol, but I think you can expect us to do a very frequent testing protocol that's really centered around the idea of surveillance, which means that we're not looking for people that are symptomatic, that we think we'll catch those on other forms of screening. What we're trying to do with testing is to detect newly infected individuals at the earliest possible state before they have a chance to spread that infection to others within that team environment. So we want to have a chance to isolate them, get them the appropriate treatment, and again, make sure they don't expose everyone else in the environment. So that means that we're going to be testing really, really frequently, and we'll have to base participation around that testing. But this is also important to note, it's not just about players. This is about coaches, about strength and conditioning staff, about medical staff, anybody that's in that team ecosystem, as we've been calling it. We'll have to test them because they're all going to share that risk together, since they'll be around each other on the practice fields and throughout the week. And that extends to the game field as well. Anybody that's again, going to have close exposure there where we can't practice physical distancing.
That is Dr. Alan Sills, Chief Medical Officer for the NFL. And Dr. Sills, also a Nashville resident. So a Nashville tie in there. A real detailed answer on Golic and Wingo this morning on ESPN Radio. And we've got a couple other clips that we want to play as we try to detail the NFL's plan of attack on how they're going to play and how to minimize the risk. As we know, there is a lot to think about here. And the more you think about it, the more stuff you think about of potential hurdles and things you're going to have to get through in order to execute a season. So, Elijah, I'm going to allow you to tee up the next two clips from Golic and Wingo this morning, and then we'll kind of kick it around.
Okay, this first one is Alan Sills discussing the maintaining of the NFL protocols that he mentioned in the last clip during a game kind of setting.
Well, I think there are a number of things you can do on game day. First and foremost, again, is look at the layout of the field, how many people are on the field, how many people are exposed to each other, and can we actually distance some areas of the field and keep people apart? So we think that's important as a first step. We're certainly looking at things about sterilization of equipment and everything, even down to the game balls and how we use that. And then I think you probably have heard in the media some reports that we are looking with a group of engineers very creatively at the possibility of some extended face shield mask type options that might be part of the football helmet, because, again, we think there may be some things that we can do there to mitigate risk from a respiratory standpoint. And then, of course, throughout all of this, you have to continue to emphasize things like good hand hygiene, hand washing, and avoiding touching contaminated surfaces. So we're really looking at the entire game day experience, from who's present to what they do, to what they touch, and what the sterilization procedures are, and looking at that through the lens of how can we mitigate risk. That's what this is all about, is what can we do to reduce the risk for every single person that's involved in that team environment, both on game day and outside the game day.
Okay, so even a detail on perhaps a more of a shield on your face mask rather than the cage and what we've grown accustomed to. It was interesting, we just asked Elliot Friedman about that part of it. From hockey, that it doesn't look like they're going to require hockey players to wear like a full, plexiglass face mask like you would maybe if you had a jaw injury or a teeth injury. You do see players play a game where they have their whole face is covered. But, you know, you have the thing fogs up. It's hard to see. Sometimes you don't want to have that. So you have to try to work through that. But I do wonder what both sports are going to do along that area to try to maybe create the effect that you have when you wear a mask, Marquise. Well, that's why we go to a grocery store with a mask on, or a restaurant. You walk in with your mask on because the more people study this, it's the best way you can limit the possibility that, you know, when those particles fly out of your mouth when you talk and you cough and all that stuff, That's what spreads it.
Yeah, I can see players wearing something like that face, like their face guard. Obviously, anybody who's on the sideline or anybody who's going to be allowed on the sideline is going to be wearing a mask, so you avoid it in that situation. Yes. I wonder if, you know, because usually when you go to the sideline, a lot of players take their helmets off. Do you, you know, do they take their helmets off and then put a mask on? And while they're sitting on the sideline and while they're talking to each other, you kind of can separate each of, you know, offense and defense. Well, obviously offense will be on the field, but the offensive player that are not on the field, you can kind of separate them from the defensive players, have the defensive players on one side of the field maybe. And it, like I said, it's going to be a lot of just weirdness and stuff that we've never seen on an NFL sideline before, especially when you see the head coach and a lot of the times the camera pans in on the head coach. A lot of them are going to be wearing masks, but, you know, I think anybody who's going to be on the sideline is going to be wearing a mask, and maybe they have like a little hand sanitizer machine to where players, after they get off the field, can wash their hands and, you know, and move on and focus on the next play. But, you know, I think that's going to be just small details that NFL implements to make the stuff work.
Go make training camp interesting too.
Hand sanitizer after every play. That, you know, that'd be funny.
But it's like it's gonna happen. It's like, okay, play's over, and it's like, okay, line up everybody. Here you go, and then everybody's just hands up. But it's something that they're gonna have to do unless players.
If it helps be able to play, then you gotta consider all of these things, right?
Unless players wear gloves.
Let's hear the last clip.
All right.
Let's hear the last clip, Elijah, from Dr. Sills, and then we'll try to tie it all together here.
This last one is him talking about meeting rooms specifically.
When you talk about a meeting room, like a quarterback room or any of the rooms, there you can actually practice physical distancing and use of masks and other PPE to reduce risk for everybody involved. So again, can you convert that exposure from what would be called a close exposure to a more distant exposure? And that's a basic concept with regard to what you do in response. If you're familiar with the guidelines, you know, the CDC and others talk about close exposures, which means you're within 6 feet for an extended period of time. So that's what I'm talking about, how you have to look at things like, how do we conduct our practices? How do we conduct our meetings? How do we lay out our facilities? All those things can be looked at and can be re-engineered in a way that reduces risk and prevents as many close exposures as possible. And so that's the stage we're in with these protocols, is what can we do at every step of our operation to look at it and to think about ways to reduce risk to the people involved. And in doing that, I think one of our athletic trainers really encapsulated it well. He said, you know, it's not going to feel normal because it's not going to be normal. Everything we do is going to be different in some way, whether it's how the building is laid out, how we take our meals, how we travel, how we practice. All of these things, I think, are things that we have to re-engineer and reconstruct, centered around the idea of how do we mitigate risk to everybody that's involved.
I think that says it well, Dr. Alan Sills. In the macro form, like the big picture, that is what I think about, is how do you minimize the risk? You cannot eliminate the risk, right? It's out there. The virus is out there. People are going to get it. What do we need to do to live with it? I think that makes the most sense to me. That's how I, you know, conduct my thinking on pretty much everything we're doing. Today, you know, the announcement was made on Monday that our city will go to phase three. And so that's been the thinking of our mayor and our leadership group in our city, Nashville, Metro Nashville, Davidson County, how to proceed with this step by step. So what else jumps out at you with Dr. Sills and the NFL there? And any details that struck you as to how they're trying to go about this?
I'm just, and I listened to his full interview this morning, and I'm just curious to see, because earlier when the first clip we played, it talked about testing players, and obviously that's going to, you know, that's going to be a process as well. It's not just, you know, checking your temperature at this point. This is actual, you know, coronavirus testing. So I'm curious to see, you know, if they do have a player that tests positive for the virus, and are you going to have to test the rest of the team? And obviously usually some of the tests are only held for people who have symptoms, but obviously some of those players aren't going to show those symptoms right away. So do you wait for, you know, 14 days before you test them? And that's what I'm curious about. And that's with all of the sports, of just how each sport is going to react to a player when they get the virus. And not only how they react to that player getting it, but how they react to the remainder of the team. Do they just go, okay, that player or five players just got the virus, let's go business as usual? Or is it something that we, okay, everybody here is going to have to get mandatory test? Like, kind of like how they did when, you know, Rudy Gobert, you know, came out and said he had it. You know, everybody on the team got tested. Anybody who's in the team facility got tested. And, you know, that's when they figured out that, you know, Donovan Mitchell had it. And so that's what I'm more curious about, is seeing how they react to, you know, players. Obviously, it's different now when we see a Texas player, we see 13 or 10 Texas players getting it. It's a little different because not all of them are on the field and not all of them are on campus practicing with each other. But when this happens during the season, or if this happens during the season, what's going to be the reaction then? Right now, we can just brush it off as, hey, Ezekiel Elliott got, you know, the coronavirus, or Cowboys players got it. But how are we going to react to it when it's within the season?
Well, that's what I was most curious about, is hearing Dr. Sills talk about one of the emphasis that they're trying to get through. He said, you know, basically he's saying it's easy. If somebody comes in and they got a cough and they have the symptoms, well then, I mean, to some degree, do you even need to test? It's pretty obvious, right? This guy is sick. He needs to be over here. He needs to be out of the way of everybody. But the toughest thing would be the people that are asymptomatic that you worry are going to have it. How much can you do to each day when you start your scrimmage, your practice, your game, can you be reasonably sure, as much as you possibly can, that everybody on the field is starting the day without the virus, right? If you could get to that point, then that's going to go a long, long way. But the trickiest thing is, what about the people that are asymptomatic? That's the toughest one to figure out.
No, absolutely. And also, like we mentioned earlier, how many coaches are going to abide by everything that's being told to them about, you know, keeping players off the field if they're sick? Because even if a player has a cough, you can have a coach thinking, hey, that's not coronavirus, he just got a cough, you know, or use that as an excuse. How many coaches are going to actually implement, like, hey, look, if you follow any of these procedures and guidelines that, you know, we got to, you know, get you off the team or whatever for right now, because, you know, this is a serious situation. We don't want to get the rest of the team sick either. So we're going to see how many coaches actually abide by that.
All right. We are out of time, guys. I really enjoyed the show today. We hit on a lot of different things, a lot of great conversations with our guests. I want to thank Tyler Kepner and Adam Vingan, Joe Rexroad, Elliot Friedman, Pete Pranica. We had a wide range of interviews today. We'll have more of it tomorrow. Jared and the GM coming up next, right here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Closing time. One last call for alcohol. So finish your whiskey or beer. Closing time. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.